Thank you very much, Dan. I'm sure all of us have given a thought at some time or another in our existence as to what marriage should be about, what it is about, and what we hope it will be for us individually. And it is clear when God created Adam and Eve and put mankind on this earth that the way he designed us and the way he designed our children or human beings to require 20 years, it seems, to grow up and have care and nurture, and then if you have two or three children, you can see that 20 years stretches out to be 30 and 40. God designed man and woman to be together for the rest of their lives. He expected that when they were to be married, they were to be married in a marriage that would last until death. There were one or two occasions, or at least reasons, that God said that marriage could perhaps then be annulled or divorced or changed, and that had to do with illicit behavior, sexual misbehavior, and it had to do with an unbeliever departing and interfering with the worship of God. But Jesus Christ said in Matthew 19 that from the very beginning, God never intended people to divorce. And his plan is if two people are converted and they live together and work together, they ought to be happy and raise their family. If the factors are there, that the other things do not interfere, as I said. But, of course, Jesus Christ also has clarified in the New Testament that in the case of adultery or in the case of an unbeliever, someone who would cause you to lose your belief and faith in God, then the converted person is not bound in those instances. It's also clear when we read the book of Ezra that God commanded the Israelites, and you can go back to Deuteronomy and Leviticus as well, commanded the Israelites to remain pure in their ancestry. The Israelites were commanded not to marry outside of Israel, outside of their nation. And in a spiritual sense, God tells people today in 1 Corinthians 7 that if we, for some reason, are no longer married, if we're married and then our mate dies, we can remarry, but within the Lord or within the faith. So the principle of marrying inside of Israel, it still carries on as far as marrying within the faith, if a person was then to remarry. And we have the specific reasons and reasons only then for divorce. So what we read is that God puts a great deal of emphasis upon marriage and upon the vows that we make and upon fulfilling those vows. Specifically, he tells us that we are to strive to remain together for the sake of family and children. We are to marry within the faith and stay within the faith and to learn to love one another and be together. We read various writings from human beings that reflect that, and in our day and age, we think of Hollywood and all the great romances, this instant attraction you see in instant love, and various things are written. Some are very meaningful and some are very good. There's a couple I want to read to you out of this Lions to Live By. One is written by Lena Lathrop. It's called A Woman's Question. And she asks here, do you know you have asked for the costliest thing ever made by the hand above? A woman's heart and a woman's life and a woman's wonderful love. Do you know you have asked for this priceless thing as a child might ask for a toy? Demanding what others have died to win with the reckless dash of a boy. You have written my lesson of duty out. Manlike, you have questioned me. Now stand in the bar of my woman's soul until I shall question thee. So here's what the woman says. You require your mutton shall always be hot, your socks and your shirts be whole. I require your heart to be true as God's stars, and as pure as his heaven, your soul. You require a cook for your mutton and beef. I require a far greater thing. A seamstress you're wanting for socks and shirts. I look for a man and a king. A king for the beautiful realm called home, and a man that his maker, God, shall look upon as he did on the first and say, it is very good. I am fair and young, but the rose may fade from my soft young cheeks one day. Will you love me then amidst the falling leaves as you did among the blossoms of May? Is your heart an ocean so strong and deep I may launch my all on its tide? A loving woman finds heaven or hell on the day she is made a bride. I require all things that are grand and true, all things that a man should be. If you give this all, I would stake my life to be all you demand of me. If you cannot be this, a laundress and cook, you can hire and little to pay. But a woman's heart and a woman's life are not to be won that way. It's very meaningful words written by this woman who has seen a lot in life, and we all probably have seen a lot in life. There's a man named Robert Ingersoll who writes something else about it from a man's point of view. I'll read that little bit to you. It's much less wordy, smaller, and more straightforward, not quite as nice and flowery. I believe that marriage should be a perfect partnership, that a woman should have all the rights that a man has, and one more, the right to be protected. I do not like the man who thinks he is boss, the fellow in the dugout who is always talking about being boss. I do not like the man who thinks he has got authority and that the woman belongs to him, that wants his wife for a slave. I would not want the love of a woman that is not great enough, grand enough, and splendid enough to be free. I will never give to any woman my heart upon whom afterwards I put chains. Interesting way of looking at things. And we read these kind of poems, and they say a lot to us, and we all hope and pray, I think, and look for a marriage which is ideal and very wonderful. The outline which God gives, the instructions he gives and gives to the nations of Israel, is to marry within your nation, within your beliefs, for fear that you would begin believing false idols and worshiping false idols and following false gods. He also says that we are to marry once for life, with the possible exceptions, as we said, death ends a marriage. So does sexual conduct, misconduct, and so does a believer who causes you to turn from God. And all of these things are in our minds and in our understanding. Until we read the book of Esther and ask yourself, how is it that God took a Jewish girl and wed her to a pagan, idol-worshipping king who was not Jewish, he was Persian, and who had at least 200 other wives? How is it that God broke every one of the stipulations that he gives us for marriage? What was behind all of this? Those should be some questions. The king to whom Esther was married was a stranger to her. She didn't know who he was. And that even in marriage, the relationship was a very, very distant one. I have listed for you on a paper, which I hope you're able to copy into your books, dates and places of the various leaders of Persia. And I don't have all of them down here, but I thought it would be good for you just to keep in mind the period of time in which this was happening, because there is irony involved in what's occurring and happening here. You see, there are three books in the Bible that were written all within that one space of time or about that space of time. And that is the book of Esther, of course, but also the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah. And they all worked around the same span of time, Ezra and Nehemiah being the ones responsible for taking the Jewish people who wanted to leave back to Jerusalem to build the temple and rebuild the city. And Mordecai and Esther apparently didn't want to leave. They didn't go with Zerubbabel or with Ezra later on. They stayed behind and maybe took some ribbing for that or some negative thoughts of that. But in the line of Persian kings who took over the Babylonian Empire about 550, the dates are not 100% exact, but it's pretty close. But about 550, they took over when God promised that after 40 years, Israel, I mean, the Jews at least, could go back to Palestine. This was Cyrus the Great who took over. And there's a question about Cyrus and Darius and the time span, because Darius was the one who consigned Daniel to the den of lions. So during the reigns of these Persian kings, several things happened. And one is, when the king made a decree and said it to do something, it had to be done. He couldn't even take his own words back. If he said, Daniel, or else whoever doesn't bow down to this idol, goes to the den of lions, or goes into this fiery pit, that was it. Signed, sealed, delivered, and a stamp put on it, and there was no changing it at all. And so the decree of the king then was absolute. Even he couldn't change it. And that's why when Daniel was in the den of lions, remember, Darius came up and said, Daniel, are you still alive? Are you still there? Did your God help you? And of course, God did help him. It's great lessons of faithfulness. So tremendous events were taking place in this span of time. I suppose you could add the book of Daniel to these others, although it just was a little bit before these series of events were taking place. Daniel would have been about possibly in his 90s already, if Darius the Great was the one that put him into the den of lions. But Daniel certainly lived to a ripe age. When he was first captured and taken to Babylon, he was a teenager, so we could say at the turn of the century, if he was a teenager, then certainly 80 years later, he'd have been about 95, 97 years old. But on this little list I've given you here, there's Cyrus the Great, 550 to 530, and he was the one that founded the Persian Empire, and he allowed Zerubbabel in 538 to go back with a small group to begin rebuilding the temple. And then Cambyses came along and stopped the building of the temple, and the whole story there is up and down, as we know. And then Darius the Great came on, and Darius the Great, from 522 to 486, the temple was completed by about 516, and Darius was also one of those who started the battles, or got involved in the battles with the Greeks, and lost a large battle at Marathon. Later on, Xerxes, the next king, or Ahasuerus, who was the one who became the husband of Esther, lost the battle of Greece of Thermopylae, a great famous battle in Greece that took place when the armies of Persia arrived. And then he also lost a battle in 490 at Salamis and other battles that he was fighting with the Greeks. I won't go through the rest of these here, but just so you have a focus in mind of what was happening. Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, the same king, reigned in Babylon from 486 to 465 BC. So that was about 100 years after the last group was captured out of Jerusalem, 100 years after that span of time, and at least 60 years or so since the temple had been started. And there were lots of things not going right with the trip to Jerusalem, the rebuilding that was taking place there. We're going to go, though, to the book of Esther, and we'll pick up on our history here and read a little bit of this remarkable story. And these books are close together, Ezra and Nehemiah, because they certainly are one with another, connected with each other. The dates on them and the years in which they were written and put together are very similar. We won't take every point in detail here, but looking at what was occurring and happening, we see, first of all, in chapter 2, there was a difficulty that we see with in chapter 1 of Queen Vashti. Now, Queen Vashti was the queen, the wife of the king of Ahasuerus, and she seemed to be a woman of very high principles, because the king had ordered her to come before him when they were having a pretty fair drunk. These men had drunk too much. She says his heart was merry with wine. And, you know, in the courts of the Persians, there was a lot of intrigue. There's a lot of pulling and pushing and tugging, and that's why Daniel ended up in the lion's den. That's why Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, this all occurred 20, 30, 40, 50 years before this time. But you see, there were people that as soon as someone got in the favor of the king, they wanted to erase them and get rid of them. And so this turmoil was going on constantly in these pagan governments and pagan rulerships. And Xerxes or Ahasuerus had the same kind of difficulties within his kingdom. And so they probably teased him a little, maybe pricked his pride or whatever they did, when he gave an order to his wife, Vashti, to appear before them virtually naked. Now, in Persia, women weren't allowed to go around that way. Look at today at the Taliban, for example. They covered their women, and the queen especially would not be seen in public virtually nude. But somehow or other, someone got him to order this, and I'm sure he regretted it bitterly later on. But he ordered it, and once he ordered it, then now the order of the king could not be disobeyed, even if it was the queen. So when Vashti said no, and that, in a sense, was a dignified, godly response, I'm not going to come in naked in front of all these drunken guys. And then, of course, the king, because she rejected his order, was forced then to eliminate her, get rid of her, divorce her, move her somewhere else. She was a very beautiful woman because she certainly had been selected, as Esther was going to be, by a beauty contest throughout the land. There was a law in Persia at the time as well that the king couldn't just marry anybody. He had to marry one of the daughters of the seven leading families of Persia. So for him to marry a Jewish girl was unthinkable. And of course Esther didn't tell him that she was Jewish when she was called. Anyhow, the king was brought into this problem in verse 1 of chapter 2 of the book of Esther. It says, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. So this time went by, and he remembered her, and it doesn't say it directly, but there must have been some regret in there, because Vashti was a pretty remarkable woman, pretty remarkable person. So then we see his servants saying, well, we'll solve the problem. Now, he had how many? Probably 100 other wives, because he had a beauty contest, 120 or 127 provinces. Every province supplied a beautiful girl, and the king has his contest, and the beautiful girls are all brought to the king. He marries them all. He doesn't just, you know, marry select one. It's not a beauty contest where you see all these talents here, and I'll take that one. He marries them all. And it's just that one gets to be number one wife, and the other would get to be, you know, number two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, whatever, up to 200 wives. Now, Solomon had 1,000 like that, and they were all remarkably beautiful girls. Furthermore, in Persia, if you were commanded to come as a possible bride to the king, you could not say no. It was unthinkable to refuse to come. It was impossible for a family to say, my daughter's not coming, you know, I want to get her to fall in love with somebody first. Somebody her own emotional makeup, you know, and somebody that she can really love and wants to be with and is kind of emotionally connected to him and so on and so forth, and all of these things. It wasn't working that way in these days. And God didn't seem to worry too much about the emotional makeup of Ahasuerus. As a matter of fact, it seems to me he was a bit of a hard person to live with. In his demeanor, the way he handled himself and conducted himself. Esther was a pretty remarkable woman. She was obviously very, very beautiful. But more than that, she was beautiful on the inside. She had wonderful character. And that shows as reflected throughout this story. So we read about this girl who was actually an orphan. She had no mother or father. She was brought up then by her relative, her uncle, sometimes called cousin. That was Mordecai. In verse 7 it says, Mordecai had brought up Hadassah. Hadassah was her Hebrew name for Esther, and it meant myrtle. So girls who are named Myrtle, there used to be years ago, Myrtle is a fairly common name for girls. That comes from Hadassah. Then, of course, it was changed to Esther, and Esther means star. Generally named, they thought, after the star or the Venus star, which is steadfast and bright and very beautiful, and so maybe that's the name that was chosen. But it said she had neither father nor mother, and the young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So she could say, life's not fair. Here I'm taken in slavery, I'm living in a foreign land, I am a slave here, I've got to do what the king says, I don't have a mother and father, where's God, you might say. But she never ever said that. Never doubted that, never questioned the presence of God in her life. And we are to be the same. No matter what occurs and happens, we cannot question the presence of God in our lives. Our important point in life is to do what's right. And this is what Esther did. She allowed God to use her as an instrument, and she always did what was right under every circumstance. So it was when the king's command and decree was heard, that when many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther was also taken to the king's palace in the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now this Haggai was a trusted old man who took all these young women, 120 of them, whatever they were, and he enhanced their beauty in every way he could, helped them, gave them tips, and did all kinds of things to make them all acceptable, because every single one of them was going to be the wife of the king. They're going to marry every one of them, not just, you know, the nicest one. So he helped them all. And Esther was of such a nice character that this man, who dealt with women regularly, favored her. He said, you know, that this gal is a jewel. She is a gem. So he readily gave her what she needed, beauty preparations besides her allowance. And she said, I don't need any beauty preparations. Pretty remarkable individual. In verse 10 it says of Esther 2 that Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. Now you might say, well, boy, she's sneaky. No, I think she's just very, very smart. This was an intelligent woman. This was a woman who had her head put on right, and she had seen the persecution of the Jewish people since they came out of captivity. She knew they were second-class citizens, and all these various things were going around in her mind. So she was living this life, first of all, as an orphan, brought up by Mordecai, very beautiful, and then suddenly her life changed. And she was selected. Now she had no choice. She had to go to Shushan, she had to go to the capital, and then get ready to be married to the king. And it wasn't somebody she fell in love with. This king was a lot older than she was. Esther may have been, I'm not sure, 16 years old, 18 years old. The king only managed to live or reign for another 20 years total. Well, at least for a total of 20 years, and then his reign was over. And Vashti was his wife at the beginning of the 20 years, so it doesn't say precisely which year in which Vashti was removed and Esther became the queen. But if it would have been, say, 10 years, then he would have been married to Esther, and she would have been queen for 10 years. That's all. Doesn't say what happened to Esther after that. But God loved her and appreciated her, and certainly then took care of her and blessed her. So in verse 11, every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the woman's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. He was really concerned about this charge of his, this girl he had brought up as his own daughter. And going down here to verse 12 then, it says, each woman, young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation according to the regulations for women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparedness for beautifying women. And thus prepared each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the woman's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines. So now, you see, after going and spending the night with the king, now you were his concubine. Now you were his wife. Second grade, third grade, whatever the category would be. So that simply, what this is telling us, this isn't very, very juicy of a romance in some ways, by our standards, by God's standards, but Esther simply went in and spent the night with the king. He tried her out like he tried out the other 120. And I'm not sure if she was number 20 or number 40 or number 60. Not very nice. And you'd wonder, well, why would God allow it this way when he gives such strict regulations for marriage? And we know how highly God esteems marriage. And our marriage vows are very, very important. There had to be a great reason. And there was. It meant the salvation of the whole Jewish nation, which upon which rested the very birth, ultimately, of the Messiah. All of that was in God's mind when he was dealing with Esther back here. Because in order for this, for the Jews not to be annihilated, all of this had to come to pass, that Jerusalem would be rebuilt, the temple would be rebuilt, there would be a people there, there'd be a priesthood there, sitting on the seat of Moses, and that Jesus Christ would be born to Mary. He had to have a Jewish mother. And then finally be the Messiah. All of that rested upon Esther. It's an amazing thing to understand and perhaps then realize why God took the circumstances that were there and worked with them in a miraculous way. He just tweaked things a little bit and changed the whole course of events forever. Quite an interesting way of doing it. He could have done it differently. He could have done it like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Throw them in the fire and they come walking out with a partner, you know. Fold them into the lions, and the lions just lick their chops and turn around the other way. He could have done a lot of different ways. But here in the book of Esther, and in the story of Esther, God worked in a unique and in a marvelous way. He just saw the events that were taking place, and he just adjusted it here, and adjusted it there, and adjusted it there, and the whole thing turned out exactly the way he wanted it to. It's a wonderful story in this book. God is not mentioned in this book of Esther. And the book of Esther is never quoted in the New Testament either. But the presence of God is felt from the first chapter to the last chapter. And the effect of this book and the effect of God's presence is felt till this day. So we read here in a little bit in this situation where Esther was with one of the concubines. She went in then and spent the night with the king. And she came out of there no longer a virgin. She came out of there his concubine, one of his wives, as all of the other 120 or so did. This wasn't a man that she had fallen in love with. It wasn't a man she knew at all. She probably could hardly recognize him. Wouldn't know him probably from other people. and yet now she was his wife. Verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but that Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advise. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. She wasn't painted up. She wasn't overdone. She was just a natural beauty. And that beauty was enhanced. And there must have been something about her regal bearing, the way she walked. Because, you know, that's a big impact. If you see people who just walk beautifully, you know, that immediately it does something to you. You see it. They stand right out in the crowd. People who carry themselves well, who sit properly. You know, we used to emphasize this in school. You know, you always were told, sit up straight, you know, and put your shoulders back and all those things. You don't seem to do it anymore. I think girls used to go to finishing schools where you'd walk around with books on your head and things like that, just to, so you walked beautifully. I look at these models walking, you know, sometimes. Have you ever seen these models walking on TV? Wow, that's not nice. That's terrible. There's nothing very beautiful or attractive about that, I don't think. But anyways, that's just me. She must have had all these things put in the right place. In verse 17, it says, the king loved Esther more than all the other women. Isn't that a great, you know? He said, well, I've tried out 50, and you're 51. I'll give you an A+. But I've got another 40 to go. Another 60 to go, so I'll see you in a couple of months' time. That's not too encouraging in some ways. But this is what God did. You see, God did something to King Ahasuerus' brain. Just tweaked him a little bit. And he couldn't fully get Esther out of his mind. He couldn't just forget her. The king loved Esther more than all other women. The word loved is not what we would think of as love. You know, not the Hollywood love for sure, not the attraction which means I love you and only you for the rest of your life and my life and all that marriage is supposed to mean. Doesn't mean that at all, because the king says, well, I love you, Esther, you're going to be, so far, you're the number one. I'll get to the next 60, and I'll see you after that. And after the next 60, he said, you're still number one, Esther. Wasn't a very good kind of a marriage. But it was a marriage, and it was a marriage which God brought about for the sake of Israel. Now, yes, Esther, being a Jewish girl, a slave girl in Persia, was subject to the rule of the land and the rule of the king and all of those things. But she should always, and she always did, keep the laws of God, nevertheless. So she remained a Jewish girl. But she did this in a hidden way, just like Daniel. He didn't eat the pulse of the king with all of the various foods in there that were unclean. He remained true to God's way of life, and yet very wise and circumspect to the laws of the land as well, and to the laws of the king. For example, Esther had no problem falling on her knees or her face, you could say, before the king, bowing down to the king, right down to the ground. She had no problem doing that. Touching the top of his staff, you might say, kissing his ring. She had no problem doing that. And that was not idolatry. And we have lessons for us to learn from this, because sometimes we think, oh, well, you know, I would never bow down to a majesty. If I see the queen, if Valerie would have bowed down when Queen Elizabeth passed over, she'd have fell off the wall. But you know, there is a respect that we are to show to the royalty that which God has put in place, or to the rulers of our land. So the king loved Esther more than the other, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than the other virgins. So he set up the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then they had a sort of a marriage. Then the king had a great feast, and a feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. When the virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate, and Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. It tells you right there, verse 20 of chapter 2 of Esther's character. She had no mother and father to honor, but she honored her uncle. She knew that this individual cares for me, and what he tells me will be good advice for me, the best advice for me, from someone who really cares. And that person may not always be perfectly right, but you know that that person cares for you. And so Esther was of that character, that she obeyed the command of Mordecai as she always had. So she was, in many ways, a pretty remarkable young lady. In chapter 3, the story goes on here, and the story of Haman begins showing up. Now, there was, again, this continued undercurrent of anti-Semitism, is what it boils down to. Hatred against Jews, hatred against any of God's people. And it is anti-Semitism. And we know that the force behind Haman, the force behind anyone who tries to destroy Israel or any of God's people, is Satan. So in fact, Esther was at war with Satan, just as we are, with the effects of all this turmoil around her. And God has laid us all, set us all in the world of Satan. This is Satan's land, it's his world. And we're to live here, and we're to worship God and serve God while we are in this land. So in a sort of a parallel way, Esther was in the land of Satan. And it was Satan then who tweaked Haman and did all kinds of things to cause the king to decree the death of every Jew. And he does that today, wanting to kill all of God's people. It's, of course, the same thing that happened in Daniel's time, and again and again and again. This never ever seems to go away, even till this day. It's astonishing. You know, think a little bit of what happened to the Jewish people. You know, from the time that they went into captivity till this day, they have never really known a time where they've not been persecuted in some way or another. Maybe a few years here and there, but you know, just one after another, a sort of an ongoing series of death to the Jews and anti-Semitism. And I don't know of a people in the studying I've done. I love history. I've never read of a single people that for that long kept their identity and have been persecuted and killed and still kept going and rose again and all these various things have occurred and happened. And Esther is a part of that and a very important part. So the lessons in here are great for us. Now this situation with Haman, then he grew to be hateful and vengeful against the Jews, and he wanted so much to make sure that there was a decree put out that the king would put them to death. In verse 8, Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples. They do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it's not fitting for the king to let them remain." Now, he was wrong. Of course, he was lying. They did keep the king's laws. The only time they didn't keep a law of the king was when it directly went against God's law, as Daniel had proven before. That's what they said about Daniel. Remember that if we're going to find anything to accuse him of, it's going to be within his law of his God. And of course, he wouldn't bow down to an idol, and that was the thing. I'm not sure how Esther got around these things. I'm not sure if they just didn't notice or whatever, but she did not give in to that which would be defined as sin. So verse 9 says, "If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasury." So the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, and the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you." You know, when you have one person in charge like that, sometimes the decisions that are made are not good decisions. And when they're irreversible, they can be deadly. And this king, as a Persian king, there was a tremendous pride there. And when he made a decision and stamped it with his ring, it was irrevocable. Even the king couldn't change that decision. So he makes this decision. Haman leads them to that. And, of course, then they go ahead and get ready for this battle. Now Mordecai comes then, I don't want to focus so much on the details of what went on with Haman in that area, I'm trying to focus on Esther more than anything else. Mordecai now comes to read about this and hear about this, and he right away thinks, well, we've got an in. I mean, Esther is the queen. And Mordecai knew from all that occurred and happened, in his mind, had no doubt in his mind that Esther was the queen for a reason. There was a purpose behind all of this. He was a God-fearing man. He believed that God led his life, and he led the life of Esther. And he was deeply involved, that is, God was deeply involved with the Jews. So Mordecai learned what was happening. He tore his clothes with concern for his people and fear and so on, and he thought right away of Esther, and he said, "Esther, you go and talk to the king. You go make a petition for us. He cares about you. He's told you you're his favorite one," and so on. In chapter 4 then, when we read about this situation, in verse 8, he also gave him a copy of the written decree for the destruction which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her. There was this trusted servant And he was the go-between between Mordecai and Esther. And he gave her a copy of the king's decree that was signed with his seal to know what it was all about. And he wanted to explain to Esther that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. That was a dangerous thing to do. To go against the king's will in the first place. To come into the very presence. Isn't it an amazing thing when you're married to this man and you don't dare walk into his presence without being invited? On the penalty of death. Not exactly the Hollywood romances that we're used to, is it? And yet, this is a marriage. It's a marriage which God expected Esther to be true to this king with the 200 other wives that he had. So Hathach returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai, and Esther spoke to Hathach in verse 10 and gave him a command for Mordecai. Well, really Mordecai knew these things, but Esther said, "Tell Mordecai, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called or specifically invited, he has but one law to put all to death." So when the king is sitting on his throne and somebody walks in uninvited, immediately they're put to death. The death penalty immediately goes upon that person. Now there was an exception. And that is if the king, he had his golden, big golden sort of a staff, if he stretched the staff out to you, that person that just came in, then you'd be accepted. You could come. But that's how strict all of this was. And it says, "Except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king for these 30 days." Not too good of a marriage. Some women think when their husbands work until 6 or 7 at night, it's kind of long to be away from home, go on a 3-day business trip. Esther didn't see her husband for 30 days, and that wasn't the first time. It wouldn't be the last time. There are months that went by, and she never ever saw the king. He had too many other wives in the first place, too much business in the second place. And so Esther could, you'd begin wondering, well, where do I stand after what happened to Vashti? You know, you can see perhaps she'd be getting a bit nervous. "I've not been called to go into the king for 30 days. And so they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai said to Esther in verse 13, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews." She hadn't told the king she was Jewish, and she was actually from the tribe of Benjamin. So when you say Jewish, it doesn't mean just Judah. In this case, it means from the tribe of Benjamin as well, which came with Judah. "If you remain completely silent at this time," Mordecai said, "relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place." So that's the faith he had. He said, "I know God can do it in any way he wants to," is what Mordecai has said. He'll send angels down. He'll do whatever he needs to deliver his people. But you see, God does use human beings to do his will and to bring his will to pass. And he was using Esther at this time. And Mordecai knew that it was so unusual for her to be the chosen wife of the king. All the events that occurred in there, maybe there were other things as well, the death of her mother and father and Mordecai bringing her up and who knows what all else that made Esther the kind of a person that she was. And perhaps as well that Mordecai, that God was just feeding him this information in dreams at night or whatever, that he knew this was a salvation for his people. "There will arise another deliverance for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to this kingdom for such a time as this." That's a remarkable verse in verse 14. Who knows if you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. So it wasn't 100% confidence that God was bringing all this about. And God wasn't working in great, marvelous ways like there would be for Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel. And this time, God was working in small ways. I mean, Esther was remarkably beautiful. That's why she was selected to be one of the concubines. Did God make her remarkably beautiful? Well, he may have had a hand in that. Maybe he tweaked things, the DNA, just a little tweak here and there. Maybe her nose wasn't as prominent, you know, as some of them would be. Of course, being of Benjamin, not of Judah, maybe that was a problem that was solved right there too. But you see, God worked in here, and Mordecai said, well, who knows if that's the reason you're the queen now. So he wasn't getting, you know, the kind of messages in his ear, angels coming at night and so on, telling him this, taking him by the hand as Lot was taken out of the land or something like that. He just said, who knows? It looks like it. It seems to be. There's a great need, and you're in that right place. So then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather the Jews who are present at Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go into the king, which is against the law, and if I die, I die. If I perish, I perish. That's a remarkable thing for a young woman to say, because this couldn't have been any more than within the first year of marriage to the king. So she still would have been, if she was 16 or 17 when she married him, she would have been 18 or 19, a remarkably mature, a grown-up young lady here. So Mordecai went his way and did according to what Esther had commanded him. It is interesting that they did fast for 3 days and three nights, not eating or drinking anything. I recall once, years ago, Mr. Armstrong asked us all to fast for 3 days and not to have anything to drink or anything to eat. And we all had to be careful in doing that. So it was something which is not easy for a person to do. So they did all of this, and of course then Esther did her share as well, and then she showed her great courage, and using her intelligence, in verse chapter 5, on the third day after the fast was over, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace. So she dressed herself up to be what she was, which was the queen. Now that would make the king immediately realize, recognize her. You know, that's a thing you've got to remember. Is that I'm not sure how good his eyesight was. You know, Ahasuerus could have been at this time, who knows, 60 years old. We don't know that for sure, because he only reigned another maybe 10 years. And usually at the end of the reign of an absolute authority like this, there's only one reason that his reign has ended, and that is he's been taken out of somewhere feet first. So I would guess that Ahasuerus at this time was an older man, maybe 60 years of age already, or whatever he would have been. So maybe he couldn't see so well. So she wore her royal clothing. He would recognize that. He would know it's the queen. As you got closer, then he'd recognize her even more so. But you can see that all these thoughts had to be in her mind. And it also gave a dignity to her. And the very fact that she dared come into his presence would have signaled to him this is important. So there was a lot of various factors that were there. And it says then as she got dressed this way, the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house, so it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight. And again, here's God just tweaking things a little bit. That all he had to do was just to remind Ahasuerus, remind him, hey, you know, you haven't seen your queen for a month, but she's the one you selected as your favorite, and tweaking his mind just a little bit. The king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand, and Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And that was an acknowledgement from Esther, too, that the king had accepted her, and a sort of a thank you and an appreciation. So then the king asked her what she wanted to have. It shall be given to you up to half of the kingdom. He may have wanted to take those words back after he said them. Why did I say that? He may have thought to himself. But maybe, again, it's God tweaking things a little bit in his mind and in the mind of the king. So Esther reflected incredible courage in here, and she answered him then, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him. So here was a woman who had every reason in the world to be afraid, to have her knees knocking, to be perspiring, to be very, very upset about what was occurring and happening, it might happen, if I die, I die, she said, and yet she exhibited incredible faith and trust in God, knowing that this was a good deed she was doing, and that she was in a position to do something for her people, to sacrifice herself, give herself for her people. That's a wonderful lesson to learn. I think right now it's being learned in the church more than ever before. We're having a great emphasis upon servant leadership in the church, to understand that the ministry are the servants of the people, not the lords and masters of the people. And the emphasis upon servant leadership through the Council of Elders is very strong in the church right now. It's a lesson that is not easy to learn for some. It's a lesson that some will have to learn maybe the hard way or getting hit across the bridge of the nose once or twice. But it is the way in which God works. He selects individuals to lead his people that love the people. And Esther did, in spite of all that had gone on in her life. And so she hid the fact that she was Jewish, but there was a reason for that, because the king was not supposed to marry a Jewish girl. He was supposed to marry a Persian girl. And the queen was supposed to be one of the top seven families of Persia. So the king said, bring Haman quickly, and that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther prepared. And so the story goes on then about the way that she continued to do these things. She invited the king again. Chapter 6 tells us, here's God now tweaking a little bit. That night the king could not sleep. That happens from time to time. That's a normal kind of occurrence, isn't it? And God could have caused it by a miracle, but you see, God uses that miracle. He uses the king, and he uses Esther, and he uses Esther's beauty. He uses the pride and arrogance and power-hungry search that Haman had, the wisdom of Mordecai. And God just reaches in and sort of tightens this screw a little bit, you know, loosens this one up, and just tweaks things along. That night the king could not sleep, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. Chronicles were just sort of the events, sort of like the minutes of the meeting. What occurred this last week? What occurred the week before? What occurred the month before? And it was read to the king. Now that wasn't an accident. That was that precise night that happened. This is God working. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers, who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And his life was threatened many times. Assassination was one of the most common ways of death for a ruler in these nations. The king then said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed upon Mordecai, who was the one who revealed that secret and saved his life? And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done. And so then you see how God brought the king then to pass a statement about Mordecai, where he was going to give him a great honor and dignity and so on and so forth. In chapter 8 of Esther, in chapter 8, we read here that Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman. Haman came to his end. Actually, the end he had decreed for Mordecai was given to him. He was hung on his own gallows. And that Esther had been given the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And actually, the queen had a lot of cities she was given, properties that she was given to control. And Mordecai came before the king for Esther and told how he was related to her. So now it was clear that Esther was, in fact, Jewish and of these people. And the king took off a signet ring which he had taken from Haman and given it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. And Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet. And here's, again, a lesson for us all, because we think, well, you know, you shouldn't bow down. God's people don't bow down to anybody but God. You bow down to God and nobody else. Well, Esther bowed down. She fell down at his feet. It wasn't just because it was her husband, because he was the king. And that was a custom at the time. Now, there are certain people that you should not bow down to or kiss their rings. That's true. If it has to do with idolatry, an idolatrous ruler of some kind, and he wants you to kiss his ring as a recognition of his religious authority, that's a different story entirely than a political leader, your king or a king coming. So she implored him, Esther implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which she had devised against the Jews. But you see, the king could not take his decree back. That's the problem, the dilemma he had. He couldn't say, oh, he canceled the decree where the Jews are going to be slaughtered. He couldn't. And the king held out the golden scepter towards Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes. And that's the third time she's talking about these things. So she said, you know, if I make you happy. That should tell us that she had tried to make him happy. So here's her husband, whom she hardly knows and sees once a month, but she remembers what marriage means to God, and she's trying to be a godly wife. Not an ideal situation for anybody to be in. And that just speaks, I think, all the more to Esther's incredible character, what a marvelous person she was. Let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedath the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who were all the time in the king's provinces. But the king couldn't do it, you see. So she said, how can I endure to see the evil come upon my people? How can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? And King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman. They have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. But you yourself write a decree concerning the Jews as you please in the king's name, seal it with the king's signet ring, and whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. So though he couldn't revoke his initial statement, he said, write a different one that'll sort of cancel it. And so they did. And what they wrote was, the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. And for 2 days they can kill anybody who is their enemy. So, you know, if people had their ideas to go ahead and kill the Jews, now suddenly the Jews were arming themselves and they could then kill their enemies. There's an interesting sort of an end to this in Esther chapter 9. And this is sort of when it comes to the final victories that they've all now won, going down to verse 12 of Esther 9. It shows us here that Queen Esther agreed with the deaths of Haman's house. And actually there were hundreds of people killed who were all enemies of the Jews. Verse 12, the king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the citadel, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It shall be granted to you. Or what is your further request? It shall be done. And Esther said, if it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do again tomorrow according to today's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. In the commentaries that I've read, there's a question about this comment from this lovely young lady who was the queen. Kind of bloodthirsty, it sounds like. No mercy, it sounds like. And actually, you know, in this government, it was that way. Once the king made a statement and turned away, there was no mercy, there was no change, it was to be done, like in Haman's case, for example. And in a sense, the queen was the same. She had that kind of authority. The king gave that to her. But you see the situation here, and her request is that they be hung and that the Jews get an extra day to kill their enemies. So now the Jews celebrated from then on the festival of Purim, and celebrated for 2 days because Esther gave them 2 days to eliminate their enemies. And when you read about it, actually, there's 500 here and 300 there. It isn't that there were thousands that were killed. It is that there were some who had gone so far in making their plans to destroy the Jewish nation that these were the ones that would be annihilated. It wouldn't have been people who just, you know, common people walking on the street that they would have killed. So the king commanded in verse 14, this to be done. The decree was issued in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. And the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, killed 300 men at Shushan, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. The remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together, protected their lives, had rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. And so there was a retribution. I'm sure that it was guided by God, and then the Jewish nation was then saved. And then, of course, after that, verse 20 on to verse 26, the Feast of Purim was instituted as a feast of national deliverance. Now, we see in here in the Feast of Purim, which means lots, the Feast of Lots, it's a reflection upon the lot that came upon Haman. He designed evil, and the evil came upon him. So I've taken a few notes for us to think about, as far as the result of Esther's life was concerned. Thinking that it doesn't say any more about her, whether she had children, whether she moved somewhere else afterwards, whether the king died, or any of those things. Initially in the paper you have the points of the years in which he ruled, and she was then queen. I would say probably the last 10 years of his rule she would be the queen. And then he probably died or was killed in something. He had battles with the Greeks, which he was losing those wars, and there was a lot of internal problems in the Persian Empire. But Esther was a favored child of God and would have gone on, certainly, and been blessed by God in whatever the rest of her life gave to her. But I would say then by the age of probably 26 or 27, for Esther, she would very likely, after that, have been a widow. I would think that Ahasuerus would have died. I tried to look that up in the books that I have at home, in my history books, and I couldn't see any details as to the life of Ahasuerus. We don't know what happened. Normally, if a king dies like that or is killed, normally his wives become the possession of property of the next king, as in David's case. King David took the wives of Saul, with him. And David then had a whole list of wives. And none of this is right. None of it is good. None of it is brings ultimate happiness. And so to think that Esther had a happy married life on our terms would be wrong. She was very pragmatic. She lived her life and saved her nation and was given respect and honor and dignity and all of those things, but not what we would call a loving marriage from a loving husband. And certainly not from the poetry that I read to you either. That's the particular way that we would like to see a marriage. And perhaps we want too much of a marriage ourselves. Perhaps we look for ideals, which may be in the kingdom of God, but in this imperfect world, we're all imperfect people. And part of the lessons are then that we need to respect the position God puts us in and work within that position. And so these points, there are a few of them from the book and a few that I've added to them, so you may add some to yourselves. We sang a beautiful hymn to begin with, Great is Thy Faithfulness, and that really is a theme that goes throughout this whole book of Esther. But God, the way God works, you know, isn't always by giant, huge-sized miracles and angels coming from all over the place. Sometimes it's just taking the events of the world and just tweaking here and tweaking there. And the outcome is incredible. The outcome is marvelous. And yet what weighs in the balances is enormous. The existence of the Jews and the building of Jerusalem, upon all of that hung the coming of Christ, his life and his death ultimately. So Esther taught us, and we learned to seek divine guidance in times of difficulty. Certainly we should seek that all of the time. We ask in opening prayer and the services. And we ought to be looking for that in preparing our messages or preparing the things that we write and so on. We are to learn about human nature so that we can know how to take advantage of any circumstances which may favor or our cause if it's a proper cause. So we're to learn about human nature. That's why we think about how we write articles in the Good News, for example. We don't always do it right. Sometimes we overreact in certain instances and so on. But we need to be learning about people so you can talk to them and write for them. When there's a necessity, point number three, to be ready to renounce yourself and to exert yourselves for the good of others. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. The sign amongst God's people is a fervent love for one another. And you know that takes effort. It takes effort to put the self aside and to really reach out to another person. And so Esther had that character and quality, and she ended up doing that and served God in doing so. The fourth point is to value and seek the cooperation of fellow believers. That's why God commands us to come together on the Sabbath day, to be together, to share our time with each other, because we talk about things on the same level with one another, and we need to strengthen and encourage each other. The fifth point is to have complete confidence in God's providence and not undervalue small things. There's a day of small things. It seems tiny, and yet that can be God working, just keeping a king awake at night and having someone read it and his eyes fall on that one particular passage that is the right one for the king to know at that time. So the work of God can be very, very small, but it's always there. So have complete confidence. It's so important. Sixth point is to acknowledge God as the author of all mercies. As we just sang, great is your faithfulness. Now, the Jewish people were in captivity, and they were scattered as God said they would be, and it happened not the way God wanted it to happen. Remember in the book of Jeremiah, even when Babylon approached Jerusalem, God said to Jeremiah, tell them to surrender, just to open the gates and tell the Babylonians to come in, and they won't die. But they refused to do that. And so God had to stand back and watch the people just butchered in Jerusalem. So it didn't always happen the way God intended it to, even in the last stages of the captivity. Another point, number seven, is you reap what you sow. And Haman sowed evil, and he reaped evil. So we have to be careful then of what we sow. Eighth point is the transitory nature of earthly grandeur and the end of an ill-gotten earthly power and possessions. Esther was queen for 10 years. And the king was the king for 20, 21 years. And then it was over. Somebody else was then king. And you can't have a sort of retired king hanging around. So the king lost his life, I'm sure, somewhere along that line. The queen would not have, because she's not going to ever rule. But she could have become a part of then the harem of the other king. We don't know that for sure. But earthly grandeur fades. And of course the Persian Empire faded, and empires after that have faded. And so the big lesson for Esther and for us is to seek first the kingdom of God. and His might and His glory. And the ninth point is sometimes God has a greater purpose in which He involves His people. Greater purpose. That the person themselves don't know what's going on. Joseph didn't know what was happening when he was being dragged off to Egypt. He didn't understand. He didn't know at the time. He had the dreams from God, and I don't think he ever doubted God. And in all of his circumstances, he lived according to God's will and God's way. Put him in jail. Could have cost him his life. Joseph, Hannah, Mary, John the Baptist, Job, Moses, so many of God's people really didn't know what was going to occur. Even the disciples, when Christ first called them, they had no idea of what ultimately would happen in their lives. And neither did Esther, neither did Mary, neither did Hannah, and so many others. Tenth point is to learn to be thankful with what you have to work with, or work with it. With what you have, and to work with it. The word A should be and work with it. Esther overcame great difficulties to win favor with her husband. She entered into a life of intrigue and power struggles that required all her mental skills. She remained morally upright with high standards under all those circumstances. That makes it possible then for God to intervene, possible for God to bless you. Well, that 11th point is God does not always use the great earth-shattering miracles to bring His cause to a conclusion. Sometimes He uses what's there and only nudges it a little. But the effect is enormous. And finally, the outcome can never be in doubt. The victory is already sealed. And for all of us, it's important to understand that. The outcome can never be in doubt. Christ is going to return as the King of Kings, and God's will is going to be done. And Esther knew that. She knew that that God's will would be done. Mordecai knew that. And they worked then together to allow God to work through them. So this book has a lot of lessons for us. Now, it's a book we probably don't read very often. Years ago when I had the ladies together, we would have our Bible study specifically studying the book of Esther. We'd spend a lot of time discussing every facet of her life and what she experienced and went through. It wasn't always pleasant. It wasn't always nice. But God did bless Esther and use Esther. And she reflected His presence in her life by her courage, by the way she lived her life, and then brought salvation to the Jewish people, which they remember to this day. You've heard of the Hadassah Bazaars, you've heard about the Feast of Purim. The Jewish people still remember the deeds that this young girl did on their behalf.